It's the RCR, the Retro Computing Roundtable, show 29, recorded Sunday, June 24th. But no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? The RCR is brought to you by CyberEars. If you're looking for a hosting company for your podcast or audio files, then CyberEars is the right place for you. Go to cyberears.com for all the details. Hello again, everyone. I'm Earl Evans, your host this show, and I'm joined by my regular do-gooders, Carrington Anston and David Grealish. Hey, guys.
Guten Tag, Earl Evans.
You guten Tag.
You guys doing good?
I am. I'm doing very good today.
Because we're do-gooders.
Yep. I'm
hey,
so happy.
Let's get right to it.
Let's do it.
We've got items of interest for you retro computing enthusiasts. I'm going to throw it over to David first. David's going to tell us about the Howard Canton interview and also Woz's reaction. David, what do you got to say about that?
Well, actually, I've been meaning to share this maybe for up to two shows, and somehow it just kept getting forgotten to be put on our show list. So in any case, I want to share it. So this is an interview that Mike Willigal, pretty sure is how you say his name, So he was trying to find, you know, with these recent Apple One auctions and the history of the, sort of the Apple One and different details around that. He was interviewing. Let me go back actually just a moment. I forget all the details now because it's been a little while. But I don't know if it's him or I think it's Mike who's in possession of a Apple One, or he knows someone that is, that's in a briefcase. So basically, you open up the briefcase. The Apple One's mounted in there with a power supply and a keyboard and everything. You know, so it's a workable Apple One that's portable. And cool. In Stan Veit's book, he mentions how he took one of these to either IBM or Tandy or whatever and showed it to them, or a computer club maybe, and then people were really impressed with it. And so he's been trying to figure out, is this in fact the one that Stan Veit had in his possession? And he had contacted me, and I know he was trying to get a hold of, you know, Stan passed away in 2009, so he was trying to get a hold of Stan's wife to see if this was the right one. So anyway, he ended up interviewing a guy named Howard Canton. And then two things I wanted to mention about that interview, too, is what Woz clears up or he's not sure about is, one thing that Howard mentions is that he says that Steve Jobs traded in a Fiat station wagon, not a Volkswagen bus. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And also, I guess what it was is Howard was saying that he actually designed a lot of the Apple One. It wasn't completely all Steve Wozniak. So sorry.
Well, I mean, don't some of these things wind up being kind of like an urban legend? And I mean, in the end, it's not as important the extremely specific details, but just the fact that, you know, this kind of happened and led to this. As long as the general gist of the story is okay, then does it really matter if it was a VW bus or, you know, just...
No, not really. I mean, other than just trying to know the actual true story. In the case of, like, you know, who designed parts of the Apple One, I think probably what we know is true. You know, that entire story and the Steve Wozniak. But obviously, if someone had a role in it, then they probably feel somewhat cheated if they're not at least given some bit of credit for whatever portion they had in it.
Right. That's true.
So really, I guess I'll leave it at that. Just read through it. It's very interesting. And it's just Howard's observations of the Apple One being built, different aspects of it. And then Steve Wozniak, I think, kind of straightens out a few of the details. I'm sorry, I can't speak to it better.
And I guess the you know what they call I've learned a new word in the last few weeks here through all this, the provenance,
right,
of these things is kind of getting really important because of the astronomical prices that these things are going for.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just kind of Carrington, you had actually the next news story kind of speaks to that, right? Like
it does,
the Apple One results in some of these auctions that have been going on.
Yeah, we talked about it last episode, that Apple One that was up on Sotheby's. And there was also an Apple One on eBay, but a non-functioning one. I believe that didn't sell, but the one at Sotheby's did sell, because that's how these auctions generally go. And it sold for a record price. $213,000 was this price. If you add in the buyer's premium, what they call the hammer price was actually $374,500, which is a whole bunch of US dollars. And I think the reason this sold so well was a combination of its provenance and the fact that it worked. I mean, it was listed as an operational Apple Computer One. And the idea is there's probably only anywhere from 4 to 6 of these worldwide. So it's a, you know, an incredibly important computer and an incredibly rare computer. And that combination is, I guess, the reason these things have skyrocketed in value. I remember it was only a few years ago when there was that big auction at Christie's in London, remember? And that went for just over $200,000, which I thought was astronomical.
Right.
And here we are now, one going for, you know, $375,000. So just – and I guess it's because, like, we're talking about the provenance and the fact that this is operational. But just, you know, here we are last episode complaining about the costs on eBay. Well, like, I should just shut up and accept it, because this is and
the one that sold on eBay was a bargain.
Exactly. I'd like to give a shout out though. Ken Gagne has a great write up on his Apple 2-bit site, which I like very much, and we have a link to that. I'll throw it in the show notes. And he writes up this sale, but he links to a really interesting CNN little write up about it, and he calls out the media. Ken does, for the fact that they, you know, everyone's sort of buying into the hype on this, but they say things like, you know, this is probably because of the cult of Apple, and that's why these prices go so high with Steve Jobs passing. And I think that's really underplaying the importance and of the Apple One simply as a historical artifact, which Ken points out. But Ken also points out the fact that they're saying things like, you know, that's why you should hang on to your iPads and stuff. And that shows a fundamental misunderstanding about the place and also the rarity of something like an Apple One and something like an iPad. I do think the iPad is an exceptionally important device. One could argue it's almost as important as, or maybe more important than an Apple One in some ways. But it's never, ever possibly going to have the collectible value of something like that. I can't imagine we'll get to a point 30 years from now where there's only 4 operational iPads. It's never going to be as collectible.
If so, that would be so far in the future.
Right. That
nobody would care. So, yeah. So anyway, I found that interesting. Well, but yes, it did sell, and it went for quite a hefty fund, a hefty sum.
It might be somewhat similar of like how the Ford Model T was a very important automobile that was mass produced. It was only mass produced. So how many exist nowadays? I don't know, but they got to be fairly rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but obviously they're not as rare as you know, the 1906 Oldsmobile. You know, I'm making this up, whatever. So 50 years ago, they probably weren't worth anywhere near what they're worth now, because as time goes by, there's less and less of them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the difference, is like a Ford Model T was mass produced, that was very important, versus whatever earlier automobile that were handmade and there was only a few of them in comparison, sort of like the Apple One compared to the iPad.
Right. And I think we can get to the point where there's only 4 such cars working in the world. Each one becomes quite valuable to collectors. Because at the end of the day, unlike a painting, say, an Apple II is both an important historical and cultural artifact, or an Apple I rather, important historical and cultural artifact, and also a functioning machine. So to get one that's actually functioning, I think just tremendously increases its value.
Mm-hmm.
I'd agree with that. Although I have to say, you know, again, it comes down to, if you paid that sum of money for an artifact of that nature, would you actually power it up and use it?
Be scared to use it.
I will admit now, live on air, that I actually secretly was the buyer, and I'm currently podcasting through it. And so far, it's working quite well. So I'm recording on my new Apple One.
Cool. You must have that new MP3 hookup for
it. And of course, like exactly. I'm using the Vince Briel USB MP3 recorder. It's working excellently. And like all, I'm going to review it on 1 megahertz, and then I'm going to give it away for free, because that's just, you know, that's how I roll.
Oh, guys, something just came to mind, if I can add to this. It's interesting. Is just yesterday.
Don't tell you whether or not it's interesting.
Well, just yesterday, I don't know, sometime, you know, we're recording on Sunday this time, so one day later than normal. So yesterday was Saturday. And so later in the afternoon, we're home, the family, and we're turning on the TV. And so we ended up watching Antiques Roadshow. And my 9-year-old son asked me a question, and it was something along the lines of, you know, we discussed sort of like these things about how things are valuable based on not only how old they are, but how rare they are. But he asked me, well, if there were only so many in the world, and what if somebody bought up a bunch of them and then destroyed some of them to make theirs more rare? Would that be illegal? And I said,
thoughts of children.
Well, and I said, you know, it wouldn't be illegal. It would be what would be considered unethical. You know, and if other collectors in that community found out about it, they would probably be very upset with the person. But if you have the money, you could do that. Not that anyone's doing that with Apple
One. And frankly, that would be – I wouldn't even buy them up. I mean that would make an interesting plot, because you could simply burn down places where people have – so instead of having to hire a cat burglar to steal a painting, you just go and
destroy theirs,
yeah. Their copy, so you're the only one with a Renoir left, because you simply destroy the other one.
I'm pretty certain there's been movies with that plot device in it, right?
If not, there should be.
Wow. All right, well, you know, keeping in the spirit here of all the news you can use, we've got a few announcements this show. We're going to kind of space them out throughout. One is about the Retro Challenge 2012. So I've always struggled to tell people what the Retro Challenge is. So in this case, I'm just going to read the little blurb that the Retro Challenge folks put out, because, yeah, this is like right from their own words. So it says, announcing the Retro Challenge 2012 Summer Challenge. As usual, the competition is open to all, so come and join us for a legitimized month, I guess that's as opposed to an illegitimate month, of playing, hacking, and blogging with about your retro gear. For those of you new to Retro Challenge, the philosophy is, in a nutshell, the Retro Challenge is a loosely disorganized gathering of retro computing enthusiasts who collectively do stuff with old computers for a month. The event is very much open to interpretation. Individuals set their own challenges, which can range from programming to multimedia work, hardware restoration, exploring legacy networking, or just plain goofing around. It doesn't really matter what you do, just so long as you do it. While the Retro Challenge has its competitive side, it's not really a contest. It's more like global thermonuclear war. Everyone can play, but no one really wins. So come on, give it a go. It runs during the month of July. If you want to participate or just kind of watch what's going on, the website is retrochallenge.org. We'll have a link up in the show notes. I've tried to do this every time I can. There's a winter warm-up, and then there's the summer event. And, you know, you just get in there and do something with retro computers. I mean, it's just kind of an event to kind of rally the troops. Have you guys ever done it? You guys ever done a retro challenge?
I always want to, but...
Yeah, I know we've talked about it before. I've actually registered, I think, twice, and then I didn't follow up on, you know, I didn't, maybe one time got started, and, you know, so no. I know, Earl, I see where you were tweeting, so you're going to definitely do one this time?
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to do one.
You did one last time, I know, which was a good deal.
Yeah, it was fun.
If I can think up something, I'd really like to try to do something.
I'm podcasting on my Apple One, doesn't that count?
It doesn't have to be elaborate. I mean, just like, I don't know, I'd encourage you guys to do it. Well, the listeners and you guys, because it is a lot of fun. And
what are you going to
do? I don't know what I'm going to do yet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to decide today. I got a couple more days.
Calling you out, Earl.
So, all right. So, Computer History Museum and Ducks Fort Sink. What's this about, Dave?
All right. So, here's some fun discussion for us. So recently in the news, the Computer History Museum announced that they are inducting the Ford Sync technology into their museum. And Ford Sync was also it was co-developed, or I don't know all its history, but it was developed by Microsoft. So basically, I guess it's kind of a competitor to OnStar. So I think it does more than OnStar. So it's hands free, you know, computer control in your vehicle. And I know that this has helped. So it's a good article. Read it. It's very interesting. The Ford Sync technology is great. I've never heard anything bad about it. I know that, like, Leo Laporte
well,
on Twitter Network.
Well, the J.D. Power quality study would disagree because Ford has fallen massively because I'll find a link to it. But Ford's ownership quality survey, for people, how happy they are for the cars, has plummeted.
Really, of the vehicles themselves?
Because people are saying they hate this stupid thing in their car that crashes all the time.
Really?
Yeah. It's spoken well of, I think, by people who are paid to speak well of it.
You know, I'm actually a fairly enthusiastic promoter of Microsoft technologies. I love .NET. Windows 7 works great for me. You know, just a lot of their technologies I really like. But I have always hesitated at the idea of Microsoft technology in my car. I mean, aside from the joke of, you know, your engine has executed an illegal operation and will be terminated, or, you know, worse, your brakes. I've just wondered, do I want anything Microsoft in my car? It's like a slippery slope, you know? And I don't know. I don't know if I want it. You know, it's just, I don't know how that feels to me.
Well, here's the reason I added it, and if you look in the links, there's a second link here, and I'll go on. The Computer History Museum launches new exhibit on Google Street View. So the discussion here is, this is the Computer History Museum. And granted, like, we are just talking about the iPad and how significant it is, and I'll be the first one to agree with you, Carrington, that the iPhone and the iPad are very significant in the realm of computer history, but do they belong in a computer history museum? Does this belong in the computer history museum? Do they, and them having a exhibit on Google Street View? So that's it. I just want to discuss it. What really does this?
So do you think
it is?
There,
it will
is
be historic.
There some sort of sponsorship thing going on there?
I don't know, but if I was in charge of the, I don't know who's in charge of the Computer History Museum. It's a dictatorship or anything. But if I was running the Computer History Museum, I'm sorry. I don't see these two things as related to computer history. Let's focus on what we do here at the Computer History Museum. This isn't it.
Idea, though. Like, is it the case that if it's a computer history museum, and I don't actually have an opinion yet. We'll see if we can bang one out. Should they only be displaying things that are historical, or is it a living thing where you say, here's, what is historically important and here's what's current and, maybe will be historically important. I don't know. Hard to make the call of what's existing now that will be important later.
Right. But
I don't know.
I think history should include history, and this isn't history yet. I mean, it kind of barely is, but, when do you define something as historic? This even goes way back to the early days of anybody even trying to talk about collecting computers, like on the classic computing list, which originated, if I remember correctly, in 97. And this was always an ongoing debate. How old is a computer before it's, vintage?
How old is retro, right?
It was defined in 1997 as 10 years old. So 1987. So again, when do you define something as being historical, vintage, retro, whatever, to put into a history museum? Now, I know that museums in general, I think they're so afraid of being boring and static and not interactive and not having, not attracting the masses or whatever. So that's what I think is going on here.
Well, Ford Sync, I just read, runs under Windows CE. I consider that retro.
Yeah.
So it might have come out in 2007, or 2008, but I
would
think
it's been updated. CE, what it did?
But I'm looking now at – I've never used it. I'm looking at examples of the interface, and it's pretty old looking. So maybe they were fooled into thinking this was older technology than it was.
If you go buy a car, a Ford, right now, would it have this Sync technology in it?
Yes.
And if the answer is yes, then I'd have to say that it is a stretch.
It's not historical yet.
Put it in a historical context, yeah.
My gut says
I'm with you, David.
Weird.
But to me as well is, isn't this a bit of an insult that, look at this. We've run out of great stories to tell about computer history. We better get some new stuff in here to talk about.
Maybe they were just buying one so they'd have it 10 years from now.
Well, I mean, the Google Street View, too. I mean, certainly it's significant, and it's changing our way of life and different things. But isn't there plenty of great stuff stories to be told and other things about the really old stuff? I don't know. Darn you, computer history.
It is kind of strange. Although I'm not a fan of computer dashboard design at all. I honestly just wish there was like an aux jack or something, and that's all I want. I don't want their stinking radio. In fact, I don't even want climate controls. I want to download an app. I really just wish I could have a slot to put an iPad in the front and say,
"Oh yeah,"
and it's what I want it to be, and I can have the default apps, and people can write. I mean, that would be so much nicer, and I wouldn't be stuck with a frankly hideous looking dashboard in my little Mazda.
That's a great idea. Have competing apps. You know, for those functionalities.
Well, because most of the time I just want it being displaying radio stuff. And when I want to adjust climate, then just show me climate stuff. I don't need half my dash filled up with climate things. When frankly, I think when I first bought the car, I picked the temperature, pressed auto, and I haven't really touched it since. So I really don't need half my dash used up by those knobs. Mm-hmm. So.
And that kind of speaks to, you know, this is going to be a matter of taste, and it really is hard to, like I think you were saying, Carrington, determine whether or not this will even be something historically significant later.
Right.
I mean, will people look back at this? Will it just be a blip?
And I wouldn't think it is, because I would think that navigation, like maybe the first ever in-dash GPS system, like that is something you'd put in a museum.
Yeah.
Right.
Predates the Ford Sync stuff. Ford Sync seems to be further along into the iterations of this than I think would warrant museum placement. Mm-hmm. Like the very first on-screen mapping, maybe OnStar if it was the first, you know, thing that could talk to people. I don't know.
I think so too. OnStar's definitely been around longer.
Yeah.
So, well, anyway, I mean, so back to the other part of the topic is, you know, the Computer History Museum, like any other museum, I guess they have to, you know, try to attract a broad range of people in who wouldn't necessarily come otherwise.
Who's going to come for this? Unless it's a sponsorship thing. Like maybe they're getting money from Ford.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It says Bill Ford, executive chairman of Ford, will speak with museum executives and do an induction at the museum. So maybe it is a funding thing or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
Or a PR thing. I mean, I don't want to like start the rumor mill here, but it would be interesting to determine whether or not there's any kind of sponsorship thing going on there.
I want to start that rumor. You start it, I'll spread it.
It seems a little self-serving on both parties. I mean, hasn't there been other computer-related technologies and Ford products that they could highlight, maybe at the tail end, put in about, here's what we have now, you know, this is where it's come to. But, you know what I mean? That would kind of fit better.
I don't know. It's all kind of strange. It is a weird thing that this is going into a museum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's make sure that we talk about, like, computer history stuff. Like you're going to talk about that now, right, Carrington, with the Sweet 16 starter kit?
No, I'm going to drive out of my Ford, sponsored by – yes.
Yeah. Carrington's sponsored by Ford.
The Sweet 16 starter kit is awesome, and I was watching the messages go back and forth as Ewan was determining what's in it. So let me back up a bit. Ewan Wanup has created something called the Sweet 16 starter kit, and essentially – all it is a disk image. But I think it's a great disk image because a lot of times if you want to use an emulator, you can go grab the emulator, but you don't – now you've got that. But old computers, as we know, like if you grab a vintage Apple IIe or IIc or something off eBay and you get it and it's all working and you turn it on, all you see is a little Apple bouncing back and forth on the screen saying, okay, I'm on. Now what? Fancy pants? What do you want to do? Like they don't really come with anything built in to run them. You need disks. Same thing, of course, with emulators.
Mm-hmm, right.
Sweet 16 is my absolute – it's pretty much everybody's favorite 2GS emulator. It is the go-to emulator if you want a 2GS on your Mac. But just like all emulators, okay, you have it. You run it. Now what do you do? So what Ewan's done is create a disk image, and on it is pre-installed everything you need to get up and going. It sort of completes your Sweet 16 emulation. It's on the disk image, which is about – it's like 4-something megs when you download it, but it expands to 32 or so. It's got System 601 installed and all ready to go. So you've got your operating system totally installed. It's got Marinetti 301 installed. So bingo, you can – go on, like you, when you run it, you can now get on online. You just launch it. It's got SAM2 and Snap and Safe2, which I like very much. Safe2 is the file transfer, the FTP file transfer thing. So you can get files directly from a Mac, from your Mac by FTP, and that's how you can get them in and out of the emulator. So it's got and a whole bunch of other little utilities. So it's a perfect starting point for Sweet 16. So all you do is you download the emulator, which is free. You download this this disk image, and you've got a perfectly, you know, packed, ready to go 2GS that can get on the internet, has utilities, has everything you need. There's no guesswork, and it's really, really convenient. So I just wanted to shout out to say that
it's exactly
awesome
what I need for Kansas Fest.
It's exactly what somebody needs for Kansas Fest. And if you have a Mac and you want to emulate 2GS, then Sweet 16 is totally what you want to use because it's crazily awesome. And this just makes it really easy and complete. Yes, you could go and get all this stuff on your own, but this is such a time saver. And a lot of times you don't know what you want. You know, so I have my 2GS emulator and I'd like to get on the net. Maybe you don't know what you need. This is already pre-installed. And it comes with a great PDF with the instructions and everything. And it's really, really nice. He's done a fantastic job.
Well, and in fact, I just downloaded it. Now, so what do I need to run
it? You need Sweet 16, which you get from Sheppy, from Sheppyware.net. You
okay, go so from a different Sweet website. 16. Okay.
Yes. So, yeah. So Sweet 16 is its own thing. It's an emulator.
Okay, I gotcha.
And Sheppy's made that. So you download that. Sweet 16, of course, is the computer in a sense. It's your emulator. So it needs a disk, which you can download disk images and stuff. But the nice thing is this starter kit is the disk image you want to use because pre-installed on it is the operating system, is all the internet stuff, is all utilities. And sort of it's as if you had a 2GS with a hard drive and you would spend all the time to pack everything you want on it. So you have a perfectly functional, completely up-to-date hard drive. And just Ewan's gone and done all that for you.
Yeah,
so you just
now I'm downloading Sweet 16 right now, 8.7
meg. Which is great. So it's Sweet 16 is fantastic. Been around for ages. Current version is 2.3, I think 2.3.1 is the current one. It's freeware as well, and it's like, you know, crazily fantastic freeware. So
it's very nice.
Anyway, these two combined together make for a really wonderful emulation experience. So go run, don't walk.
Very cool. I got to light up my Mac and give this a try too. Mm-hmm. I've run Sweet 16 before, but it's been a long time. I mean, it was like a really it's years ago. That's the last time I lit that up. So you use that pretty frequently, Carrington? I mean, you speak very highly of it. I mean, I wonder, how often do you use emulation versus using the real thing? And
mostly I use the real thing. I'm an actual iron guy, even though it's often so much less convenient than using an emulation. I also like the
Me too.
Virtual 2 is the other emulator I use, and that emulates an 8-bit Apple. And Virtual 2 is sort of less advanced and can do less than Sweet 16, but I like the interface a little better because it does that whole skeuomorphic thing, which normally I'm against, but I like it for an emulator, and it emulates the actual look and feel of an Apple II. So it's got the disk drives and you hear the inserting sound when you put a disk in and it does the grinding noise. And so it's really like
fun.
An Apple II. It's really good. But for the most part, yeah, I've got my 2E and I have a couple of 2GSs, and those are my go-to machines. I have the vintage computer I use the most though is I have an LC475 with an Apple IIe card in it, and it's a great combination of Apple II stuff but also on the Mac, so it makes it really easy to get it on the net and to move things back and forth, and I use it to take a lot of screenshots and stuff and screen captures. Lately what I've been using is I finally got my first Apple IIc. It's one of the few Apple computers that I of like a total model type that I've never had. I never had a 2C or a 2C plus, and I finally picked up one, and I've been using that. But the way I've been using it is through my Mac as well. So I have the Apple IIc, and the composite video comes out of that and goes into a little composite video to USB video capture box, and that runs into my Mac. And then I use the monitor port, the Thunderbolt port on my MacBook Air, goes out to a separate monitor that sits on top of the 2C. So, and it pumps the video from that onto that monitor. So I've got a nice clear monitor on top of my 2C. But since I'm running the video through the Mac, I can record, because I've been doing a lot of recording of games and things for the new 8-bit archaeology thing I'm launching. So it's a nice way that I'm sitting on an actual 2C. I'm looking at the actual 2C's image, but I can also fully record it if I want to on the Mac side. So that's the setup I'm using at the moment.
Nice.
And I
dig
it. Yeah.
And when you use that LC, I mean, that's kind of a double retro whammy, isn't it?
It
is. Because you've got a vintage Mac running a vintage Apple II, and it's not an emulator. I mean, the Apple II card is real Apple II.
And even though it's called IIe card. I think of it as an Apple IIc card because it's sort of emulating an Apple II you can't plug any cards into. So that's sort of
– Right. That's true.
But it's called the Apple IIe card. I should let people know, I think there's one on eBay at the moment, a fully sealed box, which will no doubt go for a whole bunch of money. I'm not bidding on it. But yeah, and I love the 475. It's one of my favorite vintage Macs. I have an SE30 and I have the LC475. And they're two of my favorite original Macs. I absolutely adore the 475.
Cool.
Hey, I have one last question on this topic before we go away then. So Carrington, so I have the you have the starter kit. I have Sweet 16, so I need the ROM. Now, I have a real Apple IIgs.
Right.
So in other words, me downloading a ROM from somewhere is technically not illegal.
I don't know how the legal, not illegal, whatever. Go download the ROM.
Yeah. Well,
in Canada, we're like a wild west up here. We do what we want.
But it's out there, huh? Just do a search. I can find it.
Yeah, just do a search for 2GS ROM.
I wonder why Sheppy didn't include it on his site.
It's like a legal thing. You can't distribute it because it's technically copyrighted. So
right.
Emulators never distribute the ROM. You go and have to download – the ROM files are always just floating about there, and you have to go and download that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's that kind of weird area, isn't it? Yeah, it's frustrating. I don't want to go off on a copyright rant, so I'm going to go to the next news item, which is talking about something called the Pocket Mini Computer. Sorry, but it's not really a mini computer. It's a microcomputer. But I think they already had people tell them that. But it's mini because it's small, and it's really cool. So it's this new hardware project. It's based around a propeller chip, this microcontroller that I just love. I love the architecture of this chip. But it's a combination of two boards. One is just a standard propeller. I think it's the Quick Start board. Don't shoot me if I'm wrong here, but I think that's true. And the other board is one that you have to assemble, so you got to do a little soldering, get your hands dirty. But you put this stuff together, and it comes with a cute little basic interpreter. You can run some games, you can write some programs, or if you decide to go off on your own side road here, you could program it in whatever you can use to program the propeller, like use the native language that they call Spin, or there's actually a couple of choices for C compilers for this thing now. So it's a cute little computer with 32K. You can plug in a Wii game port, you know, not the wireless Wii controller, but the little one that looks like the Game Boy controller.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it's got VGA, PS2 port, stereo audio output, and so you just plug it in and it's just like a little retro computer. It's brand new, but it's retro in its inspiration. So and it's from Gadget Gangster is where you can get the information on this, and I'll have a link. I love some of the projects that they have up on Gadget Gangster.
Oh, and it's only $50.
No, it's cheap and it's fun, and so I know the guy who's involved with this, and they he does great stuff. So go check it out.
This looks like a totally fun thing. I think $50 is a really fair price for something this cool. Nice.
Yeah, and I think it would be a lot of fun, and I would have double the fun with it because of my enthusiasm for the chip that it's based on.
I totally join you on that. Awesome. Propeller, yay.
And this is really a growing sort of little marketplace, you know, with the little reproduction computers, the Raspberry Pi and this one, mm-hmm. and the Fignition board and lots of other ones.
It is. There's more and more of this going on, and I see it as a really good thing. I see it rejuvenating.
Earl, what's your choice? If somebody wants one of these, you're going to get a Fignition, you're going to get a Raspberry Pi. What would you recommend? What's the choice? What's the best one, the best first one, the best something? Answer according to as you wish.
See, that's a hard one because I think it would depend on what you wanted to do. I think for the most general purpose stuff, the Raspberry Pi really has a lot going for it. I mean, not only is it a $35 Linux system that has Ethernet and USB, but it's also got some headers that you can connect up to your electronic stuff and mm-hmm. start doing some of the DIY, you know, some of the build-it-yourself electronic. You can attach doodads, like one guy was saying, how happy he was to make an LED blink using the Python language and connecting to somebody. And I mean, that sounds funny, but you usually don't think of a regular computer of you connecting up your electronics to it, right? Like just your standard desktop or laptop. But the Raspberry Pi, you can do that kind of stuff with, right. And there's a huge amount of buzz going. So if you could only get one and you wanted the most general purpose sort of thing, then I see that as a pretty good choice. What do you guys think?
The one thing it doesn't have going for it is you can't get one.
Oh, it's true. Still hard to get. Yeah. Still hard to get, I admit. So
vaporware.
That's the one I'd say. But I know some people have them because I've seen it on YouTube, unless it's, you know, faked, like the moon landing. So
I look at the Raspberry Pi, but there's shadows coming from different directions.
Exactly.
I'm on a Raspberry Pi, the wait list. And so they contacted me recently. I think there's supposed to be some available.
They just wrote, ha ha.
Well, soon I'll have the glorious reward of ordering one maybe in about 3 or 4 weeks.
But I guess that's the advantage of a Fignition. Like, you can just go get one.
Yeah. And they have a great little community. And I mean, for me personally, all this is slightly over my head because I'm not a programmer really. And but it's still fun to build these things and sort of, you know, do whatever you can with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, actually this one right here, this pocket mini computer one, might be a good choice for our group, the Atlanta Historical Computing Society, because we'd like to have a sort of a workshop and build one of these.
Why don't you guys just build a Ford Sync? That's historical.
And I think that the actual construction on that pocket mini computer is not like, you know, super high level. I mean, you're not baking surface mount technology things on there. I think it's all through hole and pretty easy to put together. It's not like a multi-day project. It's probably at the most like a couple hour project. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that really might be a good choice for you guys, David.
Oh, I noticed the color basic looks a lot like a Commodore screen there.
Well, that's because Jeff is, you know, a Commodore enthusiast as well as doing these propeller projects. So, kind of switching back to a combination of modern and historical. David, why don't you tell us about Microsoft and what'd you say here? Their long and tortured history.
Yeah, so this
it really is, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a quick little mention here, but there was a recent article. Actually, so on the one that I linked to, this actually has the author's name. It's mentioned in a number of other places just through AP, Associated Press. So here's Peter Svensson. Anyway, so he basically is an article about Microsoft has a long and tortured history in tablets. And so this kind of ties into current events that Microsoft recently announced their new Surface tablets. And which look kind of promising, and there's debate about whether how well it'll do and competing against the iPad and all. I tend to think they're going to do okay, at least, because it looks like a nice competitor for the iPad, at least in the
totally depends
world.
On the cost, though.
Yeah, that's the thing they didn't announce. But I think in the enterprise world, this might, you know, might give the iPad a little bit of a run. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to Microsoft. So it's a good read. And I wrote an article about the history of pen computing and the tablet. So I enjoyed reading this. Yeah, and Microsoft has tried for the longest time to make the tablet computer a sort of the preferred tier of computing. And, at Kansas Fest, I'm going to be doing a presentation called the sort of the evolution and the trials of the development of the third tier of computing. And so what I call the third tier is the handheld, which you could break up into smartphones and tablets. You know, the first tier being the desktop computer, the second tier being the laptop computer. So the trials and traumas of the third tier, you know, Microsoft has been, you know, has tried to create this for years, starting even in the 80s. And they've had a couple different announcements, a fairly major one 10 years ago in 2002, that the tablet would be the, you know, that's what everyone would move to one day, is tablets, you know, from laptops and desktops. And I don't know how long it was now, maybe 5 or 6 years ago when the tablet finally started outselling, the laptop started outselling the desktops. So it seems inevitable that tablet computing maybe would be the next evolution. I don't know if that's true, though.
I know that mobile is big, but in terms of just general purpose computing,
it has limits,
I mean, it's interesting. I spent time, well, I'm still in this particular field, but in the world of healthcare computing, right? Mm-hmm. And the time that I spent with a electronic medical records company, transcription, speech recognition and transcription was one of the holy grails of that world. But you could never get it above a certain error rate. So it, there was always that barrier that, you know, instead of using a keyboard, I'd love to be able to use voice. But I mean, we're not even there today. Still, we still don't, I mean, Siri notwithstanding, but we're still not talking to our computers as our primary mode of interacting. Mm-hmm. Also, the handwriting recognition was a big thing with, what was that company? Go?
Yeah.
That had,
Go.
Had tried to taking a crack at that, and other operating systems, like I know Palm did a lot of work in that area trying to recognize handwriting. The yeah. keyboard is a surprisingly compelling and stubborn input device for the computer. People have tried to make it go away a variety of ways, but it just it won't go away. And I still think that's one of the limits of tablet. And that's why it was the Surface thing was interesting to me, that they had a little snap-on keyboard that just looks like it magnetically snaps on there. You can attach it and detach it. But
well,
I
that
think
is
Microsoft,
the brilliant thing. That whole smart cover is actually a keyboard sort of thing. We'll see how well it works, but that's the selling point. For I saw that and went, well, someone was smart. That's brilliant.
Yeah, and you know, so I wonder if that's why that third tier has had a hard time displacing, I guess, what you would call the second tier
yeah.
of computing, which would be your portable kind of thing.
Well, yeah, and actually, you know, we may even have to break it up and almost consider the, if you will, then the tablet as a fourth tier, because obviously, even tablets as compared to smartphones, obviously a smartphone, I think it's safe to say you would never, ever try to use it as a replacement for a full-on computer. Even if it had the capability of it, the limitations of its size and the screen and everything are just won't work.
But I do use it for a lot of things I use a full computer for. Like I do yes. do a lot of email and a lot of net surfing.
Well,
on
and
my
wait, and what you just said, Carrington, is key
is
to
awesome.
my presentation. My point is, so this is highly debatable, but in my, so you'll hear this at Kansas Fest, but I don't mind spoiling it a little bit, but in my opinion, the first true smartphone was not until 2007 with the iPhone. And I argue that point because I think the iPhone was the first smartphone that had a true email client and true desktop quality web browser. So that defined the smartphone to me. Ultimately, it didn't just have internet capability. So what defines the ultimate? See, and like they mentioned in this article, the iPad's kind of just a big iPhone, which is cool in many ways, but then it's highly limiting in others. So who knows if maybe this Microsoft tablet
well,
with Windows 8 might.
Huh? Like I agree with you. The iPhone was the first phone that I used as much or as in the way that I would use a computer. But I think a lot of people would argue that the BlackBerrys had
yeah.
they sort of solved the email part of that equation. The web browsing blew on BlackBerrys, and
yes.
I will hear no dissent for that. I used it. It was terrible.
I think that's fair.
But
not so it wasn't
was
so great
awesome.
On Palm either. The web browsing,
right?
But arguably they had decent web email clients. But I think the combination, you know,
right. And also just the whole touchscreen, the whole idea that, no, you just have a piece of glass and that is the new interface.
Mm-hmm.
And iPad and stuff is really like when it first came out, everyone said, oh, that's just a big iPod Touch.
Right.
Well, in a sense, yes. And that was its point.
And so the pen interface never really kind of worked very well, is arguably, I guess. And that's been Microsoft's paradigm or their, you know, with mm-hmm. all their touch talent. But another point that's made in the article is that Microsoft was always sort of approaching the idea of scaling down a computer into either a phone or a tablet versus what Apple ultimately did, I guess, was, even though I think it's come out now where they were actually trying to develop the tablet first, then they went with the iPhone first
right.
instead. But in a way, the iPad is a bigger iPhone. They kind of scaled up and made it. I think they learned a lot of lessons from Palm in this sense, where don't try to make it more than what it's really could be efficient at doing.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Palm ate the Newton's lunch completely.
Right, because it was cheaper. So, and then there's another – been one of Microsoft's biggest problems and other manufacturers for them with the Windows tablets is the cost was just always prohibitive. So anyway, enough of that. It's
interesting. You know, I don't know of anyone who has – And yet, you're right, David, that this stuff has been going on all the way back to the 80s. Do you guys know anybody who has any of these tablet or that class of device in their collection?
No.
I have I don't have a Windows-based one, but I have a AT&T EO communicator from 93, and I have a bunch of handhelds, Newtons and Zoom, and the Casio, the competitors to the Newton.
Interesting.
I used to have a really old, but it still was like mid-90s, like a Fujitsu Windows 3.1 tablet, but I don't have it anymore.
Yeah, I had Newton devices, and I had that Mac one that looked like the Bat computer.
Really?
Whatever that was called. Not the eMac.
Sounds the eMate?
eMate. I had an eMate. Mm-hmm. I had a pal who worked at Apple got me one of those, like, way after the fact. Said, hey, we just found a pile of them. Want one? I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah, and you can buy those pretty cheap now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. You can find them on eBay really cheap. It's interesting. The oldest thing I think I have in this class of device is probably the Handspring Visor, one of the early clones, the Palm devices.
Well, some of the guys, and I don't remember the details, some of them left Palm and started that, and they were able to keep the license to the Palm software. And then, of course, Palm ultimately bought them back up. See, in one sense, you can almost argue that Visor had the first smartphone in the United States anyway. And I used to in some presentations, I would claim that they did. But I kind of started changing my mind as I researched it more. Again, Nokia had what would you call a smartphone, even in the later 90s in Europe. Not in a sense of what you expect. I mean, an iPhone is real, and then now Android devices, and I guess even BlackBerry's modern ones, they're like miniature computers in a lot of ways with limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'm going to segue to even an older but still portable computer. How's that for a smooth segue? another announcement that I have, and this is coming up in a week. I'm not sure when we'll be publishing this show. So depending on when you're listening to this, this might have already happened. But I'm trying to talk them into video, video recording this. But Lee Felsenstein, or is it Felsenstein? Do you guys know how you pronounce his
name? I think I've always heard Felsenstein.
He's going to be giving a talk and signing autographs and et cetera at the InfoAge Science Center in Wall, New Jersey. And this is, of course, where they have the VCF East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big deal.
I don't know if we have a web link for this. I don't at this time, so I'm going to go ahead and give the full address here. It's 2201 Marconi Road, Wall, New Jersey, 07719. And this is going to happen on July 1st. It's going to be at about 10:30 a.m. Evan Koblenz notes that unfortunately he couldn't be Lee couldn't be at the VCF East, but this is the next best thing. So he's looking forward to meeting many of his fans, and like the CC talk where this was announced, I'm assuming that RCR people have heard of Lee Felsenstein. But early on in the Homebrew Computer Club, community memory processor technology, with the Sol computer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the portable I was referring to, the Osborne 1, involved in all of that stuff and part of Berkeley's free speech movement. So you got to go see Lee. And again, I'm trying to twist Evan's arm here to make sure that they videotape this for those of us that are thousands of miles away and can't actually get there. And one more note, there's a $10 strongly suggested donation per person for the museum if you go see the talk.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's on their calendar on the InfoAge site, but it doesn't really – they need to do a better job, I think, sort of advertising that.
Is there at least a link, though, that has some basic information? I mean, something we could put up in the show notes?
Yeah, not on their site, other than they have a calendar and then it just say a March presentation, and it doesn't even have his name in it. But I'll keep looking.
All right.
If we can find something, we'll make sure we put it in the show notes, but I can't see anything yet either.
So while you're poking around for that, David – can you also tell that I saw this article in a lot of chatter regarding it, that, the premise is that history will exalt Bill Gates and it's going to forget Steve Jobs.
Right.
It's interesting. Very controversial.
Well, it's Malcolm Gladwell, of course.
Yeah. And if anyone's So Malcolm Gladwell's an interesting guy, and
he's a Canadian. Who cares what he says?
He's had a few books. I think his most current popular book is called The Tipping Point, How Little Things Make a Big Difference. He's done – so you can easily go and find TED Talks by
him. No, he's done – he did Blink and Outliers.
More recently?
Blink came after that, then Outliers, which was a big, big one. And then that one, What the Dog Saw or whatever was, I guess, his latest one. And I say all this in, even though I'm not actually a fan.
I've never read his books. I've seen a few TED Talks by him, in which you can freely look him up, do a YouTube search.
He's an interesting guy.
Definitely worth listening to. Actually, my company I was working for, they had sort of their own sort of a TED sort of thing, and he actually was the keynote speaker, and that was pretty interesting. And he actually mentioned, I know he's mentioned Steve Jobs before a number of times in a flattering way overall. Not to say that this is unflattering, but yes, I don't think I agree with his premise, though.
Would it be giving too much away, David, for you to tell us why, in a nutshell, does he think that Bill Gates will be remembered and Steve Jobs won't?
Well, in a nutshell, basically he's saying because of Bill Gates's philanthropy in recent years and ongoing, I guess, until he dies, or his, you know, even after he dies, I guess he'll still have his organization or whatever.
The foundation.
That's what he's going to be known for. So in the big picture, 50 years from now, you know, Steve Jobs will be much more of a footnote, you know.
Because he says there'll be statues of Gates across the third world. And nobody will, because his money will cure malaria. And can you imagine if you cure malaria, you will have saved millions and millions of lives. So, and he says because of that, that's what he's going to be known for. And then he has something about how Steve Jobs always copied everybody. He was happy ripping people off.
Yeah, that part, so, really, like, come on.
Like, okay.
I know, especially in the same article with Bill Gates mentioned. It's like, are you kidding? And I'm not anti Bill Gates or Microsoft at all.
But he's right that Steve Jobs was not exactly a philanthropist.
No.
So, like, he's completely right about
In a sense, it's not like this guy will be remembered and this guy won't because of their
– Oh, he says Microsoft won't be remembered. He says 50
what
years
would
from
I
now,
say?
Nobody will remember Microsoft.
Gotcha. Like,
I agree. I don't think Apple, you know, depending on where Apple and Microsoft are in 50 years or what they're doing, I don't think they're going to be some, you know, big, huge part of everybody's history, you know, to be worshipped or anything.
So it's not necessarily their contribution to computing that will or won't. He's saying that maybe computing just in general won't, but the other things that these people did that are significant, like the work of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that's right. What's going to prop them up. Kind of like what was the other rich fellow, Rockefeller?
Yeah.
And the philanthropy.
Right.
You know,
but it really comes down to personality and stuff. Like, if Bill Gates's philanthropy cures malaria or something like that, then yes, he will be remembered forever because, oh my gosh, you just did that. You're a Madame Curie. If not, I think Steve Jobs will be remembered more because you got the cult of personality thing. And I think it's more, you know, you become crazy old dude who kept his toenails in a pickle jar. Like, if you get rich and are weird, you're going to get remembered more.
I just don't understand how somebody could think either one of these guys will be forgotten in the annals of history. The 20th century is when computing, you know, turned the corner and started to become the focal point for everyone's existence. And I don't see that changing.
Did the general public name somebody else from 50 years ago? Like, who was the...
There's
a great point. Like, what other philanthropists do we remember either?
Yeah, already, you know, some of the names in computing. I see your point, Carrington, because some of the folks, you know, like Dennis Ritchie passing away, and people are like, well, who's Dennis Ritchie? Is it only one of the most important people in computing history if you look at the legacy?
But I don't think the general public knows. I don't think – I mean,
people
we know.
People use a mouse every day, and they're like, Doug Engelbart who? You know, and so,
But if I was to ask my sister to name five computer people, she probably would say Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, and then say, this is a silly question, and that's it. Like, I doubt she could name a single other person.
But the fact that she would name those two...
Or because they're current and huge, but...
That's true. But I mean, at some point in the history books, they're going to say, remember when computers were so quaint and these were – if they were only going to remember two or three people, don't you think these would be the guys?
Yes. So I definitely I do. So
I think so. And I think because they were embattled in a sense, and it was the and because of the story of Apple doing its thing and being so popular with the Apple One and coming out with the Apple II series and coming out with the Macintosh, which everyone said was a ripoff, and then Bill Gates coming and sort of ripping that off is the story with, you know, Windows, and then Windows completely dominating the industry and destroying Apple, then Apple having this massive comeback and becoming the biggest – I mean, that story of the two battling makes them much more famous. You know, they become the it's like, you know, Edison needs his that other dude I like better. Oh, I can't remember his name. But, you know, I think because of that, they're going to be maybe more likely to be remembered than people who
Tesla.
Arguably
Edison and Tesla.
Yeah, Tesla. Who would have contributed perhaps more, other people. But I doubt anybody else will be remembered.
If I had to predict.
I think Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and me. But that's probably it. That's the list.
So I agree.
If I had to predict, you know, so 50 years from now is – so my youngest child is 9 years old. They're going to be 59. So that's let's just say almost two generations of other people will now be on the earth. So, I'll be dead. Yep, I probably most certainly will be dead in 50 years.
But not me, and that's one of the reasons I'll be so famous.
Yeah, and even my youngest child will be – I'm pushing 60, you know, 59 years old. I predict Steve Jobs and Bill Gates will almost be equal in that one paragraph mention of them in some history book, generally speaking, because Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak launched, Apple and Apple One.
I was going to say, what about Wozniak?
Yeah, early hardware, and then Bill Gates is known for early software. If I had to oversimplify and say this, how they would fit in, they're equals. But then you dig into other stories and different circles and different way you look at it, one or the other might be granted.
And here we are,
the other.
And only niche historians will know.
If you think
about
it, that completely skips all the stuff from the 40s with the Atanasoff Berry computer, with the Mark One, the Colossus, Hewlett Packard, the early IBM stuff. It skips everything from the 50s and the seven, like the 650 series and all the big IBM things, and it skips all of the 60s with DEC and like all of that. We skip all of that. We jump to 1977 to begin. It's crazy.
I don't think they would do that because I think and let's say what. If you're taking a computer course or maybe it's just a general history work or something, I think you might have a chapter about computer history or some part
of
the chapter.
How much can it mention? Like, does the PDP-8 get
mentioned? I don't know. It depends on the – right, what kind of book it is or the course or
– And if you're in Europe, they're going to bring up the Sinclair.
Yeah.
Well, how many people do you know right now, Carrington, that if you said, what's the ABC? They'd tell you it's the first three letters of the alphabet. They have no
– And then I would smack them and say, answer again. I don't get to hang around with people much.
I think – now, one of the comments in here too is – and so, Carrington, you might appreciate this. Let's see. Let me scroll down real quick.
We'll just see if I do.
Well, they mentioned – let me see if I can find it real quick and just go and read it real here. No, it's not the right one. Basically, they make the point of obviously the people commenting here are mostly Americans, and we're all looking at it from an American mind frame or standpoint or whatever, versus maybe if you live in one of these other countries where the Gates Foundation is making such a huge impact, that's where he's going to be remembered so much more in a grander sense. Because he's not impacting us Americans, with his philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
So we only know him as the software guy.
That's an interesting point, and I think that has some merit. I think that the perspective will be different depending on where you live and what your historical legacy is. Yeah. Yeah, I can't argue with that.
I can argue with anything.
Yes, you can. But
veracity means nothing to me.
In terms of that Gates and Jobs will probably both be remembered, and the fact that they may be a couple of the only folks who are remembered, we've reached a remarkable RCR consensus. So I think I'm going to move us on to the next topic.
If I make one last statement then, being a person who's I'm a big fan of Steve Jobs, of course, and actually I'm a fan of Bill Gates in a lot of ways too. But speaking about Steve Jobs, I also don't think – 50 years from now, he has his place in history, but regardless of what are fantastic design and high standards of aesthetics and everything else that the guy had, who cares in the big picture of the world and other events and,
I would actually – I think I'd take issue with that, and I'm usually not the Apple fanboy on the show, but I would say
– You're suggesting I am.
No, that's me.
No, I think Mr. C definitely gets that moniker, but no
– I got to work harder at it.
What I would say, though, is that, you know, a buddy of mine one time was complaining that his computer wasn't doing what he wanted. And he said, I guess I need to learn some more about computers, right? Knowing that I'm a computer guy. And I said, well, I actually think it's at least as much the job of the computer to meet you halfway as it is for you to know about the computer. And I think one of the really important things about the not just the aesthetics but the user experience that Apple shines at is bringing the computer that halfway to meet you. And I think that is probably at least as important as the bits and bytes that make up the computer. So I wouldn't trivialize that contribution of saying, you know, I'm not just going to make the computer compute, but I'm going to make it more accessible to mere humans, you know, that want to sit down and use it. So I think,
yeah, I don't mean
that
to trivialize
is an important
it.
Contribution. No, I
just kind of playing devil's advocate
it.
That in the big picture of, you know, the scale of what's really important in life and over the last 50 years or whatever, I don't know if that's going to rise up.
I see what you mean. In perspective. Yeah.
And who knows, in the next 10 years, some other individual or company may change the paradigm of using personal computers so dramatically.
I hope so.
That it'll, right. It's just going to, you know, it's going to be so less as impressive anymore, unfortunately.
And we will be old enough that we'll hate it. We'll be like, oh, kids and their crazy yeah. computers and their yeah. wings and their rock music.
Yeah. And but, you know, the other factor that we haven't thought about is there could be some other technological innovation around the corner that has nothing to do with computing that may just – yeah, like what if somebody figures out how to make your own little portable fusion reactor in your house?
Mr. Fusion.
Or if there's some biotech revolution, you know, like you were saying, you'll be dead in 50 years, David, but I think Ray Kurzweil would disagree with you and say that if you keep good care of yourself for the next 10 or 20 years, you might live indefinitely.
But David was taking into account his rock and roll lifestyle, though.
That's a whole other topic.
David's coming to
that guy's turning into a cult sort of a thing.
Ray Kurzweil?
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's like
yeah,
a whole
but
little
I'm
cult
just saying,
thing forming
it's, a,
around.
It's an interesting thought, though, that technology does progress in more geometrically than linearly.
Yeah.
So some other thing could just come out of nowhere. And
by the way,
there.
I think that's absolutely crazy. I think it's absolutely – I mean, it's totally promising that, you know, so me as a 48-year-old man in our current world, perhaps I could live to be 90 years old and be very healthy, even 100. But, you know – your brain is an organ, and it
speak for yourself.
It just can't. You can't live forever. Sorry, Ray.
Well, and I'm not arguing that you can, but I'm just saying there could be some technology around the corner that makes our little, you know, puny computer stuff pale in comparison. And so, who knows in 50 years what we'll be talking about? But I know in like 30 seconds we're going to be talking about Kansas Fest.
Woo!
I have to mention it one more time because it's right around the corner, July 17th through the 22nd, and we're all three going. We're all going to have a great time. In fact, mm-hmm. we're going to record a retro computing roundtable there, as well as we've been invited to participate. I mean, they listen to our podcast, and they still invited us to participate in a panel on podcasting.
That's just a way to put us in a room and lock it.
Which I wouldn't blame
it's
them.
It's just, how do we do it?
yeah, that's right. What's our secret? And, you know, I'm not going to – I carefully guard the secret. You know, it's in my vault, you know, better than the formula for making Coca-Cola. But another thing that – this one's boring. Who's giving this one on Inform 7?
It's me. I am doing – and I barely know Inform 7 at all. I barely touched it, but that's still enough to know the very basics of it and how easy it is to –
You're there.
And no, the thing is I'm not even going to look at it before then because I know enough to be able to just demonstrate how quickly, if you want to make an old-fashioned style text adventure, how amazingly fast you can go from idea to compiled, finished, actual, working, tested game using Inform 7. So I'm going to do it sort of improv style with the audience, get some suggestions and knock together. It'll probably be a game with, like, you know, two locations or something and one small puzzle and say, there, okay, but we're done. 10 minutes, that's it, let's go. So it's not going to be the greatest game, but I do want to demonstrate for somebody, hey, you're not a programmer, you can still make a text adventure, and here's how. So that's going to be that session.
Hey, you know, curious,
nice.
Off the – what do you think if I mean, obviously I don't know any of the details of this session of yours other than what you just said, but
I don't know any details other than what I just said either.
What if you had your initial session as early as possible, then you did like two more sort of check-in sessions or whatever? And
well,
kind of
could,
we could watch the evolution of it over a few
but
days.
But it's really more just the point was, you know, you can sit down and a half an hour later have a working game. And the rest of it is about writing. Like, obviously being a text adventure, you're writing a story. So I want to demonstrate that, okay, yeah, you've got to do your story writing and come up with all the words. But separate from that, from the mechanics of I want to have rooms and nouns and a backpack I can put things in and a door I have to find a key to open and like just, you know, puzzle type things, the stuff you have in standard text adventures, implementing that is crazily easy with Inform 7. Even for non-programmers. So I want to sort of demonstrate that and say, hey, you know how to write? You got an idea for a game? Inform 7 will do the tech parts, and here's how easy it is. So I think a hands-on demo will demystify it, I think, for non-programmers and maybe make them inspired to actually write a game.
You know, I joke, but I'm really looking forward to that.
And it should be fun. I'm hoping it works.
Yeah, me too.
We'll see.
And I want to write an IF adventure about a retro computing enthusiast who's trying to quickly restore an Altair, and it has something to do with saving the world.
See, there you go. Perfect.
And that's all I know.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
And the whole point is I'm going to do it completely improv style. Like, say, ask people, okay, what genre should we be? Where should we start? Let's go. Let's really quickly. First idea, that goes in. Let's just type it and go. And maybe it'll work. Maybe it'll be a huge disaster. But I think it'll be fun as an experiment.
Well, now I'm excited. I want to do this. Can we just do this tomorrow instead?
No, we cannot.
Bummer. Because otherwise at Kansas Fest, there's going to be – and I guess we were trying to figure out, is it going to be a workshop or not? But Vince Briel is going to be there. And
well,
that's just awesome.
I had an email exchange with him, and that I don't remember why he said exactly, but he's not officially having a workshop, but he's going to be in attendance. He's going to bring a bunch of his different kits, and then I told him I want to get the what's the exact name for the one kit? That's the MP3 player for the Apple II.
The Apple II MP3.
Okay,
that's really what it's called.
So I went ahead and pre-ordered. You know, he's bringing one of those for me.
And I did one last year,
and then he agreed. You know, so he's gonna sit down with me and while I build it. So
yeah, so there's going to be
impromptu session. Hopefully other people will
join. Have a link to it. Like, yeah, it was sent out to the K-Fest mailing list, and we'll talk about that shortly, because if you're going to K-Fest, you should be on that list. Just found out Earl was not. So basically the announcement just came out yesterday that Vince will be offering, and according to the email, that announcement, it says, again, we'll offer a workshop. But it's more like he's there, you've got your kit, you do it, and he's there to offer hands-on guidance as you need it. So it's
So
rather than doing like a standalone, here, everyone do this step. They set out all the tables. You've got your own kit. You bring your own soldering iron. That's the only thing you'll have to bring is and there's a Radio Shack really near campus. So if you show up without one, you can just pop out to that and get it. So
everybody
it's still
can
doable.
Thank me.
Exactly. And I'll be bringing mine. I have a couple. Maybe I'll bring a spare. So the kits that will be available is there's the Replica 1, which is the Apple 1 kit. There's the Apple 2GS 4 meg card. You can build one of those. The Apple 2 MP3 card, which is what I built last year. The Micro Kim kit and the Altair 8800 micro. I'm going to do the Apple 2GS 4 meg card. I haven't signed up yet, but I'm going to sign up right after recording. So I'll be doing that one. I'm quite keen on this. I loved doing the MP3 card last year, which was a beginner kit. The 4 meg card I'm doing this year is also called a beginner kit. And while I have a bunch of soldering experience, so it was relatively easy, every single person who did the MP3 card last year, including a number of people who had literally never touched a soldering iron, every single person finished their kit, and every single person's kit worked. So the kits are designed really well with great instructions, and there's a number of these that are complete beginner things. Like if you do the 4 meg card or the MP3 card, those are designed for people who have never even soldered. So you can jump in and have a good time and no experience necessary. And then there's more intermediate ones like the Micro Kim and stuff. You should have a bit more experience to do one of those, or the Replica one. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm very, very happy that this got announced. The deadline for registration, if you want to do one of these, is July 8th. And that's mostly just to make sure that he's going to show up with your kit. So he's got to get the kit assembled. So make sure you sign up by then. We'll have the sign-up link in the show notes.
And as Carrington mentioned, there is a mailing list, and we will have a link for that as well.
How do you sign up for it?
Earl has it.
Yes, now that I have it. And, you know, when we talk about the show notes, this is rcrpodcast.com.
Right.
And that's where we have all of our stuff. I'll mention that again at the end, but, you know, that's it's a wonderful site, and you got to get over there and get all these notes.
And, Earl, so, I'd just like to put a little blame back in Carrington's yard, because why didn't you tell us about this mailing list earlier?
It's listed on the case. When you sign up, it should tell you. Oh, I think because you guys signed up through me.
Yeah.
I guess I should throw that out there. Navis, who's the sponsor for 1 megahertz and its resurgence, which I guess will get announced at K-Fest. That's our sponsor that's sending the three of us down to K-Fest. And I guess it's because it all went through our sponsor and I sent in the sponsorship thing. And I guess you guys never got that notice. So sorry about that.
And we'd also like for the girls and the booze in the rooms.
Those were all sent to me.
Just kidding, Navis. Curse you, Carrington.
All right, PC, go out for a long one.
Okay, you know, Cop USA is almost as big as a football field.
Well, 5,000 computer products take up a lot of... You didn't break the compact 7180 Pentium desktop PC with 8 megabytes of RAM, a 1.2 gigabyte hard drive, and more, did you?
Or the compact 100 megahertz Pentium processor PC with 8 megabytes of RAM, quad-speed CD-ROM drive, and more.
Heads up, PC! Are you okay?
Yeah, but Ed here in corporate sales is going to have quite a lump.
Well, Carrington, why don't you tell us about the Chocolate Spectrum keyboard? We're launching into the retro computing gift ideas section.
So my gift, very traditional gift, you want to give somebody a gift, give them chocolates. But in this case, there is a company called Unique Chocolate Gifts based in the United Kingdom, but they will send internationally. And they make Belgian chocolate kits, and you can get a retro camera, one that looks like an old mixtape, and one that looks like a little Pac-Man screen, which is pretty cool. But I'm going to select the computer geek. So it's Belgian chocolates, but it looks like a Spectrum keyboard. So very,
this is so awesome.
It's awesome. So it looks like you look at it, and it's a Spectrum keyboard, but it's actually Belgian chocolate. So I think they make a bunch of cool ones, and I love the Pac-Man one, and I like the retro camera, but you can get one that looks like an iPhone, but the computer geek is basically, it's a Spectrum keyboard, but it's made out of chocolate.
Do you think do you think these are actually all the same, just with a different wrapper on them, or do they actually sort of look like
I think it's like
items?
A color printing thing. I think it's the same thing, and they're, you know, you can print onto chocolates. I think it's an editable printing.
Oh, okay. Cool.
David, what have you got for us? It looks like you've got LED watches. And I clicked on the little link, and it looks like, you know, you've got your choice, but there's actually more choices if you want an LED watch.
Yeah, so I found this on Amazon. So right below this link, there's an Amazon link. But I thought it'd be more retro-looking in red, so I didn't see that one on Amazon. So anyway, this is the main company. You can order this watch for $89.99. And it's called the ZX1 Red LED Watch Drivers Retro. But I remember the style. Didn't Sinclair sort of do a style like this, like a kit you'd put together, I think, at one time? It's very neat. It's very retro looking. I don't know how to describe it, where it's the watch face is not on the very top. It's like at an angle, sort of like at a wedge shape.
So you imagine if you had your hands on the wheel and you could look over.
I see that.
So I guess that's why it's a driver's watch.
So me personally, I like the red one because it just looks more retro to me. It's $89.99 with free shipping. But then if you look at the other link, they have the green one at Amazon for $10 less, $79.99. So it's the same watch, just the display is different. So
And if you actually click on the LED watch store link that's there,
do they have
you'll
the red
see
one?
Some other more traditional LED watches as
that
well.
That top one was actually, I was going to list that one. But then I kind of thought, though, this would come up, that you could look at the other styles. Because that one looks very 70s, doesn't it?
It does. I never had an LED watch. Did you guys have one? I had an LCD was my first one.
Oh, sure. I had an LED watch.
I had
LED games.
When they went cheap, you know, when you could buy like a generic cheap one, Timex or something, the black ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's when I got one. It's probably late 70s. And then they had a calculator one.
I would hope so.
Oh, very nice.
Total nerdy.
Well, on nerdy, my retro gift idea this time isn't retro, but it is definitely geeky. I've put down a Tony Stark light up LED Iron Man shirt. So it's a T-shirt. It's $30 in stock, and it has a light up arc reactor in the thing, which I just thought was so cool. You know, a couple of my favorite superheroes here are Iron Man and Batman, and part of the reason is they don't have superpowers. It's just
they're just really rich.
Their stuff makes them so cool. Yeah, and they're really rich, which is also cool.
Yeah,
so
they combine
anyway,
into the Iron Bat, and it'll be the ultimate, you know, billionaire philanthropist butt kicker.
So you're going to need three AAA batteries, but if you have that and if you have this shirt, you can be like really geek chic.
It looks
this
cool.
This is a crazily cool shirt.
I wonder how much it sticks up, though, that area there. I'm looking at some of the pictures.
But luckily, I actually have a concave part in my chest. So for me, it'll fit flush. It's perfect.
Well, I mean, that's where your original arc reactor went, right?
Of course. No, I'm just ready for one. I pre-did it. I keep waiting.
Yeah, speaking of my 9-year-old son again, because we just got done watching watching Captain America, the two Iron Man movies. Mm-hmm. We saw the Avengers, so we've like big on this big kick, you know, with the Marvel movies. But he also likes the superheroes that sort of like normal guys that actually created their powers. Yeah, I've always been a Batman fan, so sort of the same thing. Like you said, carrying rich guys. Mm-hmm. But you know what's funny is it occurred to me the movie The Incredibles.
Love that movie.
Now the bad guy, which of course he's a bad guy versus. At first, you want to be a superhero. You know, he's kind of a bad guy, but he's also, you know, a normal guy who, you know, creates his own superpowers and stuff.
Right.
But they make him out to be a bad guy. Too bad.
Well, you can't win them all. But speaking of winning,
that's cool,
auctions.
Though.
Let's talk about auctions. Carrington, how'd your IMSI, the early Apple artifact, do?
I lost. It got no bids. Starting price was a bargain at $15,000.
Yeah, it was pretty.
But nobody stepped up.
That was a pretty steep price, even mm-hmm. given the history of that mm-hmm. machine. So not 100% surprised.
And it was a starting. It was like a bidding price too. It wasn't even a buy it now. Like that was like, we're going to open it at $15,000, which is quite high if it's going to be a bidding thing. And nope, nobody stepped up. So alas, it went unclaimed and has not been relisted as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if it comes back and, you know, under what circumstances.
Right.
So
it is too bad because it's such a cool item.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it'll come back. I think they might just, you know, knock down the price a little bit. Maybe they're sitting around trying to figure out by how much.
Right.
See, that's
right.
The thing is, just list it for something way more reasonable. Or heck, start it off at $1 or $10 and let it bid up and put a reserve on it and see what it goes for.
I hate when I'm bidding on something you don't even know what it's going to go for. So starting bid of the – I guess just maybe you need to do that to get the bidding rolling on him or something. But it'll be interesting to see if it comes back because it is a really cool item. So we'll see what happens with it.
But and no, my item did sell. For a whopping $13.95, I had that punched card gauge that would tell you whether or not your key punch or your card punching machine was doing a good job of punching things in the right mm-hmm. spot. So what about you, David? What'd you have here? You had a
working
Apple Lisa 2, yeah.
And it did not sell. So speaking of reserves, it was got up to $1,125, which is pretty good for Lisa 2. Reserve was not met, so now it was relisted. Let me click on that. And it went up to $1,525. The reserve was not met. And apparently the guy hasn't relisted it, or the person. So, nope.
So I wonder, are we seeing the end of the mania then? Because, you know, I think lots of people have been getting eBay fever and looking at this stuff and going, the prices are through the roof. I'm just going to, you know, start out at some astronomical amount and take my chances. And maybe things are calming down. I don't know.
I just think this person thinks this is – because I remember, you know, obviously we discussed this last show, and this is actually a really nice Lisa too, and it's got that X profile, whatever it's called on it, so it can boot from the SD cards, which is great. So he lowered his reserve to $2,200. Maybe the reserve on the regular bidding was like $2,000. So I'm assuming that's what the person wants to get for it. I don't think it's worth that much. Yeah, they could have got $1,500 for it. I think that's probably pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it being worth much more than that, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think eBay is just not always the best. I mean, it's a good place, but, you know, if you want to get really, really premium, I don't know. Maybe someone should start up like a Sotheby's vintage computer auction house.
That would be Sotheby's.
Well, but, you know, someone that specializes more in not mostly art and fine objects otherwise.
Because you think they can get more money than Sotheby's?
Yeah, I don't know. You're right.
$375,000.
Yeah, well, not everything's an Apple One, but I mean, I don't know. I almost think kind of the opposite, David. I think the eBay prices have been overly ridiculous. I think the market for some reason has been inflated, and I would be happy if I saw it come back down. I was at the Living Computer Museum yesterday, and they've got a couple of PDP-8s there. And, you know, I was talking to the curator. We were mentioning it wasn't that many years ago that somebody would pay you to come take their PDP-8s, you know, that they were used for some industrial purpose, and then it was time to surplus them, and you got to get rid of them. Whereas now, you know, I've seen a couple PDP-8s go on eBay for $2,000 and over. Right. Yeah, I'm realizing I'll never own a PDP-8 now, which is kind of disappointing, you know, given that it wasn't very long ago that. So I wouldn't mind if the market cooled down a little bit. I don't think it needs to go up. The only advantage I see of it going up is as the things become more valuable, it's less likely that somebody's going to send them to scrap and just grab all the gold out of them.
Yeah,
and,
that is an advantage. Good point. Yeah.
So, but on current auctions, what have you got for us, Carrington?
Well, right now on eBay, there's a few Franklin Ace Apple II clones. One of which, an old Franklin Ace 1000, is just currently has two bids and it's $5.50. And that looks interesting. There's a buy it now on a Franklin Ace 1200 as well, one of my favorite clones. But the one I'm picking is right now there's a Franklin Ace 100 Plus, which is one of the earliest Apple II clones, if not, I think, the first one. It's the one that Apple sued Franklin over. It's a buy-it-now auction for $499.99. I'm going to round that up because it's easier to say it's $500 and over $100 shipping up here to Canada. I don't know what the shipping's like in the States. It's a really nice-looking machine. I don't know if it's going to go for $500, but it's, you know, it's in good condition. It's clean on the inside. It's fully functional, which is really nice. So it's a nice and relatively rare good condition, relatively rare clone, with a nice industrial look to it. I've always liked the Franklin Ace 100 Plus. So that is my choice, and we'll see if it goes. I'm a little dubious it'll get its sale price, but we'll see.
It'd be fun to have one of those. Mm-hmm. One of the store chains that I worked at couldn't become an Apple dealer, and probably the main reason is there were just too many in the area, and Apple liked to, you know, They probably still do in these days, even though they've got their own storefronts. I mean, they didn't want to oversaturate an area with Apple dealerships. So we couldn't get Apple, but we could get Franklin. So we had the Franklin Ace. And I think either they didn't sell well enough because people would look at it and go, well, is it an Apple? But it's just like an Apple. And they'd kind of look at you sideways.
Right.
Or maybe it was the legal problems that Franklin had with Apple that made us have to pull them, but they were good machines. They worked well,
yeah.
And you know, they were
Franklin
quite
Ace
interesting.
1200, like I said, there's also a Franklin Ace 1200, which is the one with the dual drive sort of built into the top of it. I always like the look of that, and there's one of those for basically the same price as $500, but and it's a nice clean one, but that's a little less rare and doesn't have the lawsuit history behind it. So I'm going to select the 100 Plus instead.
Was this one the 100 Plus? Was this the only one where they actually stole, you know, where they were sued by Apple and then, you know, then they had to change, I guess, their code and all that stuff and the ROMs and everything? So is this the only one?
Yeah, it was a copyright thing that they were sued over, and I think they made the changes after that too, so that's why they could legally go.
Did they kind of do a compact style clean room sort of re-engineering after that? How did they get around it?
Yeah, because I think on the earliest ones, it was literally, you know what, somebody else should write in. I'm going to say, and I don't really know what I'm talking about, but my vague memory was, it was that they were literally using a code from the Apple II. Like it was like a ROM dump or something.
Yeah.
And then they created their own complete compatible version, clean roomed or whatever, after that, after losing the lawsuit. if they lost the lawsuit. You know what? I'm really vague on that now. Mm-hmm. Now my memory is...
I'm pretty sure that...
They
yeah.
may never have existed.
And then, you know, the funny thing is that they're still in business. You know, Franklin is still around.
They are the number two company in the world right behind Apple. They're copying them.
But, I mean, that does make that particular unit significant, at least, you know.
Sure. Should they make, like, handheld translators and that kind of thing these days?
They make the Frank Pad. And they're going to be
suspiciously like an iPad.
Yep.
What about you, David? What do you have for us?
And, okay, I was just looking at this other Franklin Ace that ends in 2 hours. It's only at $5.
Yeah,
$5. We'll see what it does.
It's really yellowed, and it's, yeah, I don't like that one as much, so.
So I chose, and there's a number of these on eBay, and actually this is a real nice one, and it's the cheapest one so far anyway, but it's an IBM portable, the 5155, so their first portable, sort of like their answer to the compact portable.
Yeah, I have one of these. Well, I had until it broke.
Yeah, I've had a couple of them over the years, and very heavy, you know, very durable. But so it has no bids. It's at $99.99. Reserve is not met. It's in Texas, so it'd be $47 shipping to me if I bought it. So it works. So that's pretty much it. It was something I don't think I've chosen before, or at least in a while. And you know, it's a working computer for not too much crazy money. And personally, I mean, if I really, really wanted one bad, I guess I would probably pay up to $150 for it plus shipping. I don't. At the 200 mark, though, I don't know.
I think
that starts to get a little pricey for a 5155.
Because I just want some company to start using "not too much crazy money" as its slogan in advertising. I would totally buy their computer if somebody came out and said, "Look, the new Dell 5300 for not too much crazy money." I would be like, "I'm a Dell guy, dude. I get the Dell. I would love that."
So, like, here's another one for $149, and yeah, but that's without that's bidding. But anyway, it's a neat computer. I think in a lot of ways it was probably an improvement over the compact competition. I don't know how much they cost originally, though. Were they a lot more expensive?
Oh, they were pricey. I looked that up at one time. I don't remember the answer, but a lot.
Yeah.
I'll just put it as crazy money. They cost crazy money back then. Too much crazy money.
Sort of none of it matters because we're just waiting for Earl to show his thing that he got to pick that if I had seen would have been my choice.
It's interesting, the last thing, that it had an amber display, too. I'm pretty certain they did that to distance it from the compact as well, because those are a little more preferred.
True. You know, the thing is, and I found this even modern day with the 5155, that expanding it was a pain in the neck because of the placement of the components. It was difficult to get cards. The cards that came with it to just make the thing function took up a lot of the full-size card slots right off the bat. So, you know, to try to even squeeze a half-length network card in there was really difficult. So that may have been one of their downfalls, was just the difficulty in expansion for the 5155.
Yeah, so, Earl, yours is very cool.
Well, I love these microprocessor trainers. It's one of the reasons why, you know, if I do one of the Vince Briel projects, that I would want to do the MicroKim, because I love these little, you know, the single board computer, microprocessor, educational type things from back then. They just it feels like you're really, you know, getting your hands on the hardware with one of these things and dialing this stuff in. This particular one. Now, I will note to eBay sellers who may be listening to this podcast, if you put "very rare" in your title,
we will make fun of you.
It's, you know, it's more than 50% likely that I will pass over your auction without even eyeballing it. So it's, you know, a kind of a twist of fate that I even looked at this. But so this is a...
It is really very rare, though.
That's true. This one is. So it's an ELF2 lab computer. It's, again, one of these single board computer, although it has an expansion slot that you can see here.
Crazy, it's, eh? It's amazing. I love this thing.
Yeah, I love the little, you know, keypad on this thing. And it's based on the 1802 microprocessor, which was the same thing as the Cosmac ELF. which is a little bit more well-known single board trainer sort of thing. And so you get this thing, it has, you know, 4 kilobytes of RAM. And so you just start keying in what you want to plug into it, and it runs your little programs. I don't know with this particular model whether it had as much expandability as something like the KIM. I think the KIM was originally supposed to be just, you know, here's a board for you to learn about the 6502, and people were like, hey, I'm going to turn that into a computer by adding all, hacking all kinds of things onto the side of it. But so take a look at this. It's also cool that the little board is under this plexiglass sort of thing. It looks like the microprocessor board is there.
Yeah, the industrial design is fantastic. Right?
And I like this. Yeah, yeah, and I like this powder blue sort of look for the chassis.
This is the kind of thing I'd want to have and display. I mean, I just think it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because did Netronix make this before RCA sold them? Or they sort of licensed it, or...?
I think this, if I'm reading it right, I think this came after the Cosmac Elf.
Yeah. Well, I guess so, being the Elf 2.
Yeah.
I've had some in the past when I had some S100 computers. I had a bunch of different kind of Netronic boards, but not...
Oh, really?
Yeah, RAM, I think, and I.O. boards and stuff. So they made, you know, they made other components.
So it's the same company then? I mean, when you
I think
at
so. Yeah, Netronics Research.
Yeah. Nice.
Very cool. Yeah, this is, I guess, from 77. And it had a optional full keyboard.
Yeah, look, I just did a search on eBay, and there's a Netronic 64K S100 memory board, quote-unquote, JAWS manual. That's, in fact, one of the memory boards I used to have, called JAWS.
Well, so that's auctions, and that's fun. And I'd love to have all of it, but my piggy bank is broken at the moment.
How about we should mention really quickly, that seller that seems to have placed all those massive IBM mainframes on eBay?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a seller that's got a huge collection of mainframes going from anywhere from $10,000 to $75,000 each on eBay.
So if you've got a raised floor environment and you want your own big iron, now's the time.
You're looking to
operators are standing by.
IBM, like a Z10 or a Z90 system, then, you know, you want something the size of our class. There's a whole bunch on eBay for some reason. It's bizarre.
How old were a lot of those? Did you guys look at them in that much detail?
Oh, I did not. I just glanced.
I think some of this stuff is actually not too old. I think they're Z series.
Yeah, like 90s.
You know, yeah, or even younger than that. I think some of their Z series stuff is still the stuff that they're going with today. Now,
yeah,
I
the Z9's from just a few years ago, so the Z10 I don't know as well, but the Z9 is like 2005, 2006, something like that.
Yeah. So, but you know, you need your own big iron and a terminal in every room.
Mm-hmm. And you Americans have me saying Z, so.
Sorry about that. Yeah, Zed.
I'll put the link in the show notes here for mainframes on eBay.
Yep. Where else would you buy a mainframe but eBay? Why not?
I don't know. Maybe IBM?
It's so bizarre.
Simon Systems Incorporated, yeah. IBM parts.
They've cornered the market.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think we ought to go around the table before we pull the plug. Why don't you start us out, Carrington? What have you been up to?
Well, the main thing is playing with my 2C. Like I mentioned earlier, it's new for me. It's my first time having an Apple 2C, so I'm really excited about it. It's not in fantastic condition, a little yellowed, but it works perfectly, all the keys and everything. So I've just been really enjoying it. And then having to figure out how can I use the software and record it for the new video podcast and stuff, and how to route that through what I was going to do, and finally coming up with a solution that's easy and lets me feel like I'm just typing on the 2C and looking at the results on a monitor just propped up on top of it, but at the same time routing it through my Mac so I can record everything and doing all the screencasting stuff. It's been really fun. So the last week or so I've been doing a lot of that, and I spent like an hour this morning playing Choplifter, and like, what's a better way to spend a Sunday morning? It was awesome.
There is no better way.
Just having so much fun with it.
So what about you, David?
Nothing really to mention.
David has not existed for the last
No, I've been kind of a lot of personal stuff going on, family and job and different things, been taking up a lot of my time since our last show. So nothing to really mention. I mean, other than I've been thinking about Kansas Fest, and I'll say now, when is it? Was it 3 weeks now? Yeah, about 3 weeks away. So, you know, so definitely I'm starting to plan and think about how to, you know, how, what I'm going to bring, you know, flying in. It sort of limits, you know, my options. So, so that's really it. Just really looking forward to that. That's going to be, you know, a little vacation as well.
Cool.
So maybe more to say at our next show.
Yeah. Which will be live and in person.
Oh, wait, I do, you know, and so now after saying that, I do have something to mention. So, you know, I've been collecting original Mac Logic boards for some years. Anytime I came across some that were not inside a Macintosh, or if the machine was broken or whatever, I salvaged the Logic board out. So I have a few of the original, and then I have some pluses and some SEs. And I think I have about 25 or so.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and years ago, I took an original one and I framed it and I gave it to a friend of mine, and I just thought it was kind of cool. And I think an original Mac or an early Mac Logic board is very interesting because it kind of is like the entire computer on one board. You know, you've got your RAM, you got your microprocessor, your RAM, your ROM, your input, output. You know, obviously, you don't have display and, you know, power and all that stuff, but it kind of is like an entire computer incorporated on one board. And it's really interesting and neat to look at. So I've been kind of debating maybe doing another Kickstarter. I don't know if it'd be appropriate or not, but a Kickstarter so that I could buy a really nice premium frame and really do it up really nicely. And like have a little plaque engraved with the history, you know, telling what the board is, a picture of the computer, and frame it up real nice in a shadow box type of frame.
Oh, sure. And you don't need, if you only got 25 of them, you don't need a lot of people to contribute.
No, right. And I thought, you know, so I'm kind of been thinking about doing that or how to go about it and, you know, make a little extra money, get them out there. It's like sort of like pieces of art.
So I'm thinking of launching a site called Kickstopper, where you can contribute to make people not do things. Like, I don't want you to put out that product.
That would
and
be
all
great.
These people have contributed to say, look, we'll just pay you what you would have made. Please don't make that thing
You should
exist.
Do that.
I think it could be big. So anyway, go on.
So,
I was just wondering, David, do you have a Mac 512 board in that set of?
Well, yes or and no, or yes or no. I can't be totally sure. I guess I could look up like what the RAM chips would be, because the earliest ones they just say Macintosh on them. They're 1983, and the processors you can tell they're older. And then when they came out with the 512, they had a board where it had like a little checkbox for whether it was a 128 or 512.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I assume the RAM, obviously the RAM that's populated is different, right? Because they're the same otherwise. So those check marks aren't there. So I guess I'd have to look.
Didn't they have a model number, though?
Yeah, there you go. Maybe you're right. I'll look it up. Why? Because you might be
interested. I think I have a Mac 512 Logic board that I could contribute to your collection.
That'd be cool.
So
now get this. What I did recently is I ran them all through the dishwasher.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if they're not going to be operational again, that's a nice way to clean them up.
And, you know, and to be honest, in some cases, I can't be totally sure they all didn't work, but I didn't destroy any working computer to get these out of, or I acquired them from people where they were already out of a computer and stuff. So, yeah, I want them to be clean and look good. And one thing I'm debating, I haven't tried yet, is to buy a nice polyurethane and sort of seal them to put them inside the frame. I'm not sure if I want to do that or not. But I might consider doing that. But, yeah, that'd be cool. But anyway, let's get off that. But that's something I think it might be fun and maybe get them out there as art pieces.
Yeah, cool.
Absolutely. So on my end, I went to the Living Computer Museum yesterday, and I took my daughter. It's the first time that she's gone with me up to one of the Seattle Retro Computing Society meetings.
Like the first one in 2 months or something, right?
Yeah, because they've been doing some renovation. The place looks great. Man, the second floor there, they got new carpet, and, you know, they've really done some great stuff, and they're moving things up to the raised floor environment it was already in a raised floor environment, but they're moving it into a new computer lab sort of thing. So, I mean, you can see everything from PDP-7, PDP-8s, a bunch of PDP-11s. They had a new PDP-15 there. DEC System 10, DEC System 20, and an Altair. I mean, one of the things that Jessica and I are thinking about doing this summer is coming up with something that's a look-alike, sort of like modeled after the Altair with switches and LEDs. in a sense, kind of like the thing that Vince Briel has with his Altair 8800 Micro, but more, it wouldn't really be an 8080 or a Z80. It'd be something like a propeller chip or, I don't know, an Arduino or whatever, doing the back end logic, but that it would still be an emulator of one of those systems and that you'd still toggle in programs with the lights and the LEDs. That's something that we think would be a lot of fun. So I, you know, she got to see a real live Altair running programs to kind of get an idea of not just from photographs, but this is what the thing really looks like. So we had a great time up there. That was fun. I always love going up there for those meetings. I hauled a couple of S100 chassis that I had to, you know, there's a couple guys up there that are real S100 buffs. So I wanted to see like what all I had and is it, worth doing anything with.
What were they?
Kind of, and kind of not. I mean, the chassis themselves are great. The S100 backplanes are the newer style with terminators, so they could run the higher frequency boards. The power supplies, you know, old 70s and 80s stuff. So the electrolytic caps on there are probably just one power cycle away from blowing up. And one of the guys there was telling me that in a lot of cases, he's replaced the old chunky power supplies with a new switching power supply at the same voltage. And so then the machine's not stock. But on the other hand, those big power capacitors, I didn't realize how expensive those things have become to replace. Like lots of money, like $80, $100
for
one of those.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, at least that's what they told me. So it's like, man, I no way I could afford that. So I would just make that little part of the system a little newer and just cheat. But so anyway, yep, that's what's up with me. So what do you think, gentlemen? Is that a wrap?
I think so. Probably went a little long today, but that's okay.
So that's all for show 29. As always, thank you all for listening and being a fan of the show. And we still need your help in spreading the word. So please tell somebody else about it. Mention it on a discussion list, on your blog, on Twitter. Post it up at your local coffee shop. A quick review on iTunes would be super great, too. Because the more we get over there, then it kind of builds momentum. So go to rcrpodcast.com for the links and show notes. You can email us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We love to get the emails. And also you can follow us on Twitter. And, you know, you can also heckle us over on Twitter with the account @rcrpodcast. So retrocompute, everyone, and see you at Kansas Fest.
Yeah, show 30.
Awesome. Take care,
guys.
Bye.